Caverly. My co-host, Elizabeth Caverly, and I welcome you to the hard-hitting news program, The Divided Kingdom, the program with a Christian focus we've been producing since 2003. You can visit us at thedividedkingdom.org on the Internet. Our July and August 2018 programs have been filled with crucial info you need to know and share with family and friends. Visit thedividedkingdom.org. We can be heard on WWCR, Worldwide Christian Radio, on Thursday evenings at 8 p.m. Eastern Time. Go to WWCR.com, click on transmitter number 3, or hear us on shortwave 4.840 megahertz at 8 p.m. Eastern Time, Thursday evenings. Also check out 7.490 megahertz on Saturdays at 8 a.m. Liberty Works Radio Network carries us on Mondays at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, repeating at 11 p.m. Go to their website, LWRN, that's Liberty Works Radio Network, LWRN.net, and check out their other programs. Well, now that Pennsylvania Attorney General Shapiro and the grand jury have weighed in on the decades of Roman Catholic priest abuse, finally, after days of silence, Pope Francis sent a letter to the U.S. Is this half-hearted or what? Let's hear first from a columnist who is usually very pro-immigration and is sympathetic to the Roman Catholic Church. She may well be Roman Catholic herself. So it is even more telling to hear her condemning criticism. Brenda Chavez is chairperson of the Center for Equal Opportunity and a senior fellow at the Niskanen, I hope I'm pronouncing that right, Niskanen Center. Time for Another Reformation by Linda Chavez, Tuesday, August 21st.
And this is Elizabeth Caverly. We thank you again, all of you listeners, for your wonderful money support this summer. And we were in a really desperate position, and Lou and I now have a home equity loan that will be helping us somewhat, too. So we are very grateful for anything that you send us when it doesn't deprive your family or you of your basic needs. If anyone has sufficient money and wants to tithe, certainly you can send something to us, but we can't take checks directly. A check of any amount, $10, $5, it has to be made out to WWCR. And you can write us letters of encouragement, and you can pray for us. If you can't send money, money is very fleeting. You remember the story of the man who built the big barns in the Bible? And he was taken. So you want your life to count. And so we're praying for all of you that your life circumstances will improve. Whatever you need, that person in Johnstown, Pennsylvania, we're praying for the family matters to get better and the money and everything that Satan is using to attack you. He's attacking all of us all the time, especially those of us who are on the front lines. Please keep Alex Jones in your deepest prayers. He may not have a perfectly, what would I say, Bible-believing, committed kind of Christianity, but he's been calling out for Jesus Christ and God to help him. And we do know that he's one of the last bastions of all of our freedom, the freedom of the press, the freedom to speak our minds, the freedoms in America. So do please pray for him and pray that the Lord Jesus will take him out of that New Age stuff that seems to really confuse him at times. Let him see more and more that we are flawed beings, all of us here on earth. We are all sinners, and we have no real hope. We are certainly never going to make ourselves divine. We have talked about the Mormon so-called Christian religion, the idea that God was once a man and that men will eventually become gods. This is absurd. We will all face the grave at some point. And what will be left of what we did? Will your children and grandchildren say that you did what you should do to keep America good? Not just great, but good. Well, now let's move to Linda Chavez. Few words can describe the horror that comes from reading a Pennsylvania grand jury report on sexual abuse by Catholic priests in state dioceses over a 70-year period. At least 300 priests used their roles within the church to prey on the innocent. They groomed their victims with special favors, sometimes mixing church ritual with their depravity, passing around their child victims to other priests, even recording sex acts to create pornography they could share and indulge in long after. One priest targeted an entire large family of young girls, raping siblings successively over the years. These priests were men respected in their religious communities, welcomed into the homes of the faithful, entrusted with the spiritual care of believers. But most importantly, they never were punished, even when their transgressions became known. When their superiors learned of the priest's behavior, many bishops sought ways to cover up the criminal acts. Because our criminal justice system imposes limitations on how long after crimes are committed the acts can be prosecuted, nearly all of the men who are still alive face nothing more than embarrassment for the destruction they wreaked. The church will face financial penalties, robbing the contributions of the faithful to pay settlements to victims. But no matter how large the sum, settlements will never undo the harm done. Can the Roman Catholic Church survive this crisis? The Pennsylvania story of priestly abuse is only the latest scandal to rock the church. In the United States alone, the church paid out some $4 billion between 1950 and 2015 to victims of sexual abuse. And it's not only here, but around the world that these cases have come to light. Australia, Canada, Chile, France, Germany, Ireland, and other countries have experienced major scandals involving Catholic clergy. Meanwhile, the Vatican has done little but issue condemnations and occasionally remove bishops and cardinals who either covered up or were participants in the abuse. The most striking case involving Cardinal Theodore McCarrick, the former Archbishop of Washington, D.C., who resigned from the College of Cardinals after allegations that he had abused both minors and several seminarians over the course of decades. Pope Francis, who has a mixed history in terms of how he has handled abuse cases, has so far remained silent about the Pennsylvania study. And I have to interject now, we've had this long delayed, half-hearted letter. But Linda Chavez goes on to say something must change, and it must happen soon, or the church risks losing its flock and its influence. It may well be time for another reformation. It has been more than 500 years since Martin Luther nailed his 95 theses to the door of the cathedral in Wittenberg. What followed was not just a schism in the church that created Protestantism. The counter-reformation of the Catholic Church itself came too. Pope Francis could lead such a movement, first by cleansing the church of anyone in the hierarchy who has been complicit in the abuses. But the church may also have to come to terms with the arcane rules for priestly celibacy. There is a dearth of vocations in the church, with fewer men deciding to enter the seminary and many parishioners lacking a resident priest. This vocation crisis might be remedied, at least partially, if priests were allowed to marry. Other rites beyond the Roman rite within the Catholic Church permit priests to marry already, as do the Eastern Orthodox churches and Protestant denominations. It is striking that no comparable scandal to that within the Roman Catholic Church has erupted in those denominations. Marriage is no fail-safe from carnal sins, but celibacy seems to have been a breeding ground for the disordered to seek fulfillment in predatory behavior. Until the church reforms itself, it cannot expect its followers to respect its teachings. The church has done much good throughout the ages, including our own, but it also has proved itself as corruptible as any human institution. The current scandal is that those in power to remove priests who abuse children have not done so. These men should be defrocked and put into the criminal justice system to pay for their crimes. Pope Francis has only a small window to do something to convince Catholics that the church is worth saving. Victims need more than reassuring words. They need action. And in Time magazine, August 27th, we had a small but very pungent article revealed Pennsylvania Church Abuse, a Catalog of Sins. It's hard to comprehend the numbers. 1,000 victimized children, 300 priests, 7 decades of abuse kept silent in a single state. But the stark details in the August 14th Pennsylvania grand jury report into sex abuse by Catholic Church leaders are nauseatingly easy to picture and hard to erase from your mind. The ring of clergymen who took nude photos of a boy posing as Christ on the cross. The Allentown priest who forced a boy to give him oral sex, then washed his mouth out with holy water. The teenage boy raped so aggressively over several years that his back was injured. In most cases, it's too late for action. Many of the accused are dead, and almost all their crimes fall beyond the state statute of limitations. Cardinal Donald Wuerl, the former Pittsburgh bishop accused in the cover-up, faces questions that will threaten his position as Archbishop of Washington. He denies the claims, but others will never face justice. That knowledge is hard to bear, but there is a measure of justice for the victims. As the members of the grand jury wrote of the abuse, now we know the truth. It happened everywhere. And then we have another Roman Catholic reacting. This is Mark Shields, columnist Mark Shields. Wednesday, August 22nd, there's just a little bit of what he said, a church lacking sympathy. I could testify from a lifetime of personal experience that practice does not really make perfect. Since the presidency of Harry Truman, during which I had the honor of being the youngest altar boy in St. Francis Xavier Parish to serve the standing room only midnight mass on Christmas Eve, I have been a practicing and manifestly imperfect Catholic. After the recent Pennsylvania grand jury report on sexual abuse, which tells of more than 1,000 victims enduring criminal cruelty at the hands of some 300 Catholic priests, I am consumed with anger toward my church. Of course, I am also sad, but I remain even more furious toward my church's hierarchy and its rush not to console the victims, but rather to lead a systematic cover-up of priest crimes against defenseless children to protect the institutional church from legal liability and deserve public outrage. Mostly missing from the church's reaction was human sympathy. Absent was any trace of Pope Francis's call for the Roman Catholic Church to become a, quote, field hospital after battle, end of quote, to first take care of those suffering. The clerical leadership's reaction was instead to turn the crimes and the crisis over to the lawyers and the public relations people to retreat to a circle of silence. I am angry. Such bad and indefensible decisions have repeatedly been made in secret rooms where the counsel and wisdom of parents, especially mothers, is neither sought nor welcome. By repeating this pattern of behavior first seen in the Boston Archdiocese in 2002, the hierarchy has provided persuasive ammunition to the church's opponents and critics, neglected the hurting, and failed the faithful. And I'd have to wonder there, was Mark Shields rather, shall I say, surreptitiously? No, that's not quite the word. Maybe the word is subtly. Was he referring to what we heard about this sort of a secret society element within this predators group, that they were in a circle, sort of a circle of silence? I think that may well be the case, but we've got to get more on this ongoing story. Lou.
Here are some fallout and easy statements of apology that appeared, and this appeared Sunday, August 19th, 2018, in the Associated Press. Bishop expresses remorse, and that's in quotes, remorse, after sex abuse report by Natalie Pompilio, Dateline Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. A Pennsylvania bishop named in a grand jury report on rampant sexual abuse by Roman Catholic clergy said Friday he has, quote, profound remorse, unquote, and offers his heartfelt apology to the victims. Speaking at a mass of forgiveness, Harrisburg Bishop Ronald Gaynor opened by reading the first paragraph of this week's stunning report that said more than 300 predator priests had abused more than 1,000 children in 6 Pennsylvania dioceses. 45 of the priests named in the report served in the Harrisburg diocese. The first paragraph of the nearly 900-page report said the grand jury knows the truth, that child sex abuse within the Catholic Church happened everywhere. Quote, in the name of our global church, I voice again my heartfelt sorrow and sincere apology to all survivors of clergy sexual abuse, Gaynor said, while acknowledging the church is faced with a, quote, spiritual crisis, unquote. Gaynor said most of the abuse happened long ago. The diocese has taken, quote, significant and effective measures to protect our children and remove any person who intends to do harm to them, he said. Hey, and I'm interjecting, this is Lou. Wait a minute, long ago? The next paragraph gives a lie to this. The article goes on to say, the grand jury report criticized Gaynor for failing to advocate the defrocking of an abusive priest. The diocese defender, Gaynor, saying he took swift action against that priest. The diocese defended Gaynor, saying he took swift action against that priest and another abusive priest after becoming bishop in 2014. Well, 2014 wasn't that long ago, was it? In early August, the diocese released the names of 71 priests and other members of the church who had been accused of child sexual abuse and said it was holding accountable all Harrisburg bishops of the last 70 years, announcing their names would be stripped from church properties. And now we hear from the Baltimore Sun. Elizabeth, do you have something to interject?
I'm just confirming what you thought, Lou, that 2014, that's 4 years ago. I don't think that the story is finished at all. And as Lou said, we're now moving to the Baltimore Sun because we have to have a little bit of Jesuit damage control. Remember that Pope Francis is a Jesuit. And remember that the former Pope Benedict is what some people think in almost house arrest. Is this a Jesuit conspiracy beginning to unfold, too, within our government? We've been talking about Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch, that they both went to Georgetown Prep. They had strict Jesuit training. And we know that Captain Darrell Eberhardt has always feared, from his work in intelligence and his research on the Jesuits, fomenting nations being taken down through the centuries, their role in the Civil War, which is largely covered up. All of this, we have to keep our eyes open. We hope and pray that we are not coming to something like that. We also have to acknowledge that behind the violent left, one of the key figures is George Soros and all of his billions of dollars. The UN, they are all helping to bring in the radical Islamic jihad into Europe. So we can't just blame the Jesuits. And as Lou has told me, he has a lot of books on the early explorers like Francis Parkman, and there were some Jesuit missionaries who saved people in the wilderness. Not every Jesuit person is an evil person. So we, at this program, like to look at individuals, but we cannot always look at individuals because there is the swamp. The swamp is sort of emerging again, and we've said this, that we look to the work of Doug Hagman, who investigated what was going on in Afghanistan, and it looked as though our troops were preparing people here indirectly to keep that war going by having the terrorist camps. And one of our previous programs told you where all these camps are over the United States. It's horrifying. But these people were then sent on, you see, to Afghanistan. And so we talked about it looked as though the West was interfering again to arm ISIS again. And there was another article about thousands of jihadi fighters go underground. Islamic State morphs into new terror threat. And that was an article back in the Washington Times. So we cannot believe everything we're being told. It's just like a neat cartoon that we saw today in our paper. There's a middle-aged man. He's sitting in his chair, comfy, and his glasses are sliding down his nose, and his curly-haired wife is standing there looking at him, and they hear something on the television. And what they hear is, "War is peace." ignorance is strength. Truth isn't truth. The wife says, Orwell? He says, Giuliani. Okay, so we know that there are a lot of lies about Trump. There's viciousness going on. And I am so sick of hearing on the radio, the classical music station from Baltimore, every news release that comes out there now starts with Trump, Trump's lawyer, Trump's lawyer, Trump's lawyer. I think the New World Order should get their act together, because the people of America are getting just so fed up by hearing this constantly. It's going to have a boomerang effect. It's going to have a backlash when the midterms come. Don't you think, Lou?
Oh, I think you're just right. I think that the average American, well, they may not be highly in favor of Trump. They are sick and tired of this propaganda. And that's what it is, propaganda by CNN and other major news organizations, Washington Post, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
And now we said that we would get the sort of a damage control from the Baltimore Sun through the Jesuit outlook.
Yes, in addition to what Pope Francis said, his delay of silence, we had a subsequent follow-up article in the Sun. Was this the truth, or was it damage control to make Maryland clergy system appear snow white? You listen and decide. This appeared on August 17th, Baltimore Sun, by Pamela Wood. Priest had no reports locally. A priest who was accused of improper sexual relationships with girls in Pennsylvania and later allowed to minister in Baltimore was not the subject of any abuse reports in Maryland, according to the priest's religious order and the Archdiocese of Baltimore. The Reverend Arthur Long, who died in 2004, was among hundreds of priests named as alleged abusers in a report this week from a grand jury in Pennsylvania. After Long was reported for having inappropriate relationships with girls in 1987, he continued serving as a priest and was allowed to come to Baltimore by the late Cardinal William H. Keeler. Keeler had served as a bishop in Pennsylvania and was notified when the allegations against Long were made, according to the grand jury report. After Long returned to Maryland, where he had been ordained in 1955, there were no reports of inappropriate behavior, according to the Archdiocese of Baltimore and the Maryland province of the Society of Jesus, commonly known as the Jesuits. Quote, "We have no record of abuse committed by Father Long," said Sean Kane, a spokesman for the Archdiocese. He said Archdiocesan officials combed through the records of priests in 2002 when it first published a list of clergy who had been accused of abuse. Kane said, quote, "In preparation for the disclosure, the Archdiocese reviewed the files of every priest, including religious order priests, and there was no allegation made against Father Long during his time here," unquote. Long's religious order also had no record of wrongdoing in Maryland. Said Michael Gabriel, a spokesman for the Jesuits, Maryland province, quote, "There were no allegations of inappropriate behavior during these brief time periods," unquote. Long lived at St. Ignatius Parish on Calvert Road, or Calvert Street in Mount Vernon, that's a section of Baltimore, for a year, in 1988 and 1989, while he worked as a hospital chaplain down the street at Mercy Medical Center, according to Gabriel. After that, he returned to Pennsylvania, living in Jesuit communities at the University of Scranton and St. Joseph's University. Long returned to Maryland in 1992 and spent 6 weeks living in a Jesuit community associated with Loyola Blakefield High School. He did not interact with students or faculty at the school, Gabriel said. Long had taught English at Loyola early in his career in the 1950s. There were no abuse or allegations at that time, Gabriel said. Long was dismissed from the priesthood in 1992, according to Gabriel, although the grand jury report indicates Long wasn't forced out until 1995. Long's obituary, published in the Star Ledger newspaper in Newark, New Jersey, said he, quote-unquote, retired in 1992. The Pennsylvania grand jury report criticizes Keeler for allowing Long to transfer to different dioceses, I guess it should be, and continue ministering after the allegations were made.
There's that word again. I think that's like our nemesis. I kept calling it dioceses, but you looked it up, Lou, and I think we just have the singular and the plural, the diocese, I believe.
Well, you know what? The dictionary we had, which is a good one, did not give any way to pronounce the plural as out of the ordinary, so I don't know what to think. We're going to try to avoid that some way in the future. At any rate, going on with the article, the grand jury report cites a 1995 church memo about Long that states, quote, shortly after his assignment reports, shortly after his assignment, reports were again received of inappropriate behavior on his part, unquote. Kane said that memo likely refers to the alleged abuse in Pennsylvania being, quote, newly brought to the attention of his religious order and which resulted in his departure from ministry, unquote. Archdiocese of Baltimore officials have been studying the grand jury report to see if any priest should be added to the public list of accused priests. The initial list included 57 priests and 14 have been added since 2002. Archbishop William E. Laurie of Baltimore announced this week that a new Catholic school planned for Baltimore City will no longer bear Keeler's name. And again, that appeared in the Baltimore Sun on Friday, August the 17th, 2018.
Now, I just ask you, is it pretty logical that this man who did all these predatory crimes in Pennsylvania once he went to Maryland, he turned over a new leaf? There wasn't one thing wrong. We're not sure about that. This whole thing is a big, big story. We know it is. And I think Linda Chavez, if she is the Roman Catholic, has the good idea there to help the church to change by letting the priest marry. This is a problem throughout society, and I've told in this program before how I personally saw something happening when I was teaching in a poor African-American school many years ago, that I had this young child, maybe he was a fifth grader, and he would rush over when the janitor came, and it looked almost like a love fest, and the janitor patted him on the head, and he said something about, I'll be here on Saturday or something, and later I talked to the child, and the child said, I come over and I help him, and he pays me $5, and I thought, uh-oh. So I reported this. I reported it to a minister out in the community, and then I fell under a lot of scrutiny and I think a little danger because we had heard that this man held a knife under the other janitor because he wouldn't go away for the weekend with him. So this is what we're dealing with. It's in the educational world. God protected me. I went home and I called my father and he said, you did the right thing. Now get away from the situation as fast as you can. And my mother gave me her usual hard-hitting wisdom. She said, when you go up to the head of that school, because he was implicated in some ways, she said, you just act like you always did. Just make a joke right away. And that way the suspicion will die down that you were the whistleblower. It worked. It helped. I was able to finish out my teaching career. But then, you see, I was in a Roman Catholic school, and it was a really fine place in many ways. Much good work happened there. There was a priest there. I'm trying to remember his name now, but he was just a wonderful human being. He made sure that three little girls from one family who could not afford to attend the school, they were so poor and their clothes were torn and dirty, and I taught some of them in special reading. He made sure they had free tuition. I never heard one iota of any question about him. He later died of cancer. I think he suffered quite a bit. There are men like that. But at the same time, I had someone there in that school who knew quite a bit about all of it. And she told me that in the Wilmington diocese, it was known that all of this stuff went on. And then I had to face it. I had to make a decision once more. Did I help? Did I interfere? And I have to say again about that first boy, after I had blown the whistle, years and years later, Lou and I were walking down a shopping mall, and there went this young African-American man, now about age 22, with a girlfriend. And he turned, and I turned at the same moment. We recognized each other. He was that student that the janitor was going to pat on the head and keep paying the money. And we had a nice little talk and reunion. But I knew that God said, see, see, you did right. This boy turned out to be heterosexual. He has a girlfriend. He's going to have a good life. He's not going to be abused and destroyed. You did right to stand up. And so, once again, I had to face this because there was a motherless girl who came into my room and she said, I'm going over, and it was to another area of the school where there were special teachers for special other things. And she said, so-and-so is going to be with me, and like no one's going to be there. I just got the picture immediately because the rumors were there, once again, between the woman principal and this other woman who did this special curriculum. So I wrote a letter to the head nun in Wilmington, and I didn't know what was going to happen, but I said to her I didn't want to cause any trouble with people, but I did not want children to be harmed. Well, there I was sitting in my little reading enclave, and all of a sudden I felt a hand on my shoulder, and I had two students, a girl and a boy, with me, and I turned, and there stood the sister, and I thought, oh, here I go. And she turned to them, and she said, you have a wonderful teacher, she said to them. So I had hope that she was going to try to do something. So she talked to me a little bit, and I expressed these things again, and she didn't say what she was going to do. But interestingly, later, I was called on the carpet. The principal wanted to know what I had talked to her about, and I lied. I said I was talking about that it wasn't fair for my sick leave. Someone else got more. Of course, I wasn't going to reveal what I had talked to her about in my letter. But interestingly, after that time, that principal and the other woman who was in this special curriculum, they were always invited to go to important things, to important meetings, other places in the Roman Catholic circles. They were given positions of more importance. And I thought that this sister had been very wily. In other words, she knew they had backgrounds that had driven them to this, to be predators if they were going to be. But she intervened, and they were given responsibility and respect, self-respect. And I always thought that that was rather wise, and I always hoped that what she did had worked out. But when you get to the hardcore things like we're talking about here, these 70 years of these hideous things, the crimes have been committed. It's too late to do something like what I did there as a person. And I hope that God used my little decision there to help that girl, at least that one girl, the motherless girl, I don't believe was molested. But now, let's get to the profile of Cardinal Wuerl.
And this is from the New Bern Sun Journal. Cardinal Wuerl's record on pedophile priests, an editorial viewpoint. In 1989, barely a year after he became the Bishop of Pittsburgh, Donald W. Wuerl, now a cardinal and the Archbishop of Washington, wrote what at that time was an extraordinary letter to the Vatican. The subject was pedophile priests. In it, according to a sweeping grand jury report on the Church's complicity in covering up for hundreds of alleged predator priests over the decades in Pennsylvania, he told Catholic Church officials he had undertaken a review of abuse cases in his diocese. Parishioners, he wrote, were entitled to know if abusive priests were assigned to their parishes, the usual pattern in many dioceses. Not only do priests have a moral right to expect chaste conduct, that phrase was in quotes, a moral right to expect chaste conduct from priests, he wrote, but also bishops and dioceses could be liable if they failed to act or complain on complaints about what he called the quote-unquote crime of preying on children. Wuerl's advice was enlightened and ahead of its time. He then proceeded to ignore it a number of times over the course of years. He told the grand jury in a statement that the Pittsburgh diocese policy under his leadership was, quote, to err in defense of the flock as opposed to the shepherd, unquote. But the facts of several cases tell a different story. And the effect of his actions was to put children in jeopardy. One such case involved a priest named Ernest Paone, P-A-O-N-E, known as a predator to the Pittsburgh diocese since the 1960s. Wuerl acted to enable him to continue in his position in a variety of roles. Having been ordained in Pittsburgh in 1957, Paone remained subject to the Pittsburgh diocese's jurisdiction. As the grand jury report notes, Peon was neither recalled nor suspended following an allegation in 1994 that he had abused a boy several decades earlier. Both options were available to Wuerl in his capacity as bishop. In 1996, when church officials in San Diego asked Wuerl to swear an affidavit for insurance purposes that Peon had, quote, not had any problems involving sexual abuse, unquote, of minors, he declined, directing a diocesan official to respond that all appropriate material had already been conveyed. In truth, the Pittsburgh diocese had mentioned only the 1994 allegation about Peon, along with the information that a psychiatric evaluation of the priest had not produced a diagnosis that he was a pedophile. Other allegations for Peon's Pittsburgh file were not shared with the diocese in San Francisco, where he taught 7th and 8th grade students for nearly 20 years. Peon remained in ministry until 2002, when the Boston Globe published its groundbreaking reports on the church's systematic cover-up of clerical child sex abuse in Massachusetts. Only then, 8 years after Wuerl was fully briefed on Peon's record, did the Pittsburgh Diocese act to remove him from the priesthood. It also reported to prosecutors one fresh allegation of abuse dating from the 1960s, but by then it was decades too late to prosecute Peon under Pennsylvania law. He died in 2012. In at least three cases described in the report, Wuerl did act to remove abusive priests from the ministry. In another instance, he refused an order from the Vatican directing him to reinstate a priest who had been accused of abuse. However, in other instances, he was more tolerant. He allowed a priest with a history of inappropriate sexual conduct, Thomas O'Donnell, to live and work next to a school. He permitted a priest named George Zerwas to resume its ministry in 1995, despite multiple reports that he had sexually abused minors for years, until Zerwas was placed on administrative leave months later, following yet another report of abuse. Rather than removing Zerwas from the priesthood, Wuerl approved payments tantamount to a pension for him until 2001, when he was murdered while living in Cuba. Wuerl then presided at Zerwas' funeral, where he declared, quote, a priest is a priest. Once he is ordained, he is a priest forever, unquote. The Pittsburgh Diocese told the grand jury in a statement, quote, today we would have handled the Zerwas case much differently, unquote. In yet another case involving an abusive priest named Richard Zula, Wuerl in 1989 authorized a $900,000 payment to the family of his victims. The settlement included a confidentiality agreement, barring them from discussing the case, which was the subject of criminal prosecution at the time. Zula died last year. Wuerl said the Pennsylvania report, quote, confirms that I acted with diligence, with concern for the victims, and to prevent future acts of abuse, unquote. In fact, what emerges from the report is not a picture of consistent diligence or concern for victims. Some of Wuerl's defenders point out that his record is better than that of bishops elsewhere, who routinely covered up for abuse of clergymen. But that is a low standard indeed, and that's reprinted for the New Bern Sun Journal.
And there are predators in some other places, too. We have this horrifying article here. 98% of red-blooded Americans, and this is Elizabeth talking into Heartland, do not care what the media piranhas say about Trump's derogatory remarks about illegal immigrants having a criminal enclave in their midst. And here we have this horrendous, horrendous story about Molly Tibbetts. Let's first get this little part here.
This is from Fox News, August 22nd, 2018. Molly Tibbetts' murder suspect worked less than 3 miles from where she was staying. Again, from FoxNews.com. The man who was arrested in the murder of Molly Tibbetts, the University of Iowa student who disappeared last month, worked less than 3 miles from where she was staying the night she vanished. Christian Rivera, 24, was employed by Yerby Farms for the past several years, according to a source with knowledge of the situation. The Des Moines Register reported that it reviewed documents that listed several owners of the farm, which included Dane Lang and Eric Lang, both relatives of Craig Lang. Craig Lang, who owns a dozen property deeds in Brooklyn, Iowa, is reportedly a former 2018 Republican candidate for Secretary of Agriculture in that state. Dane Lang said Rivera worked there for the past several years and was an, quote, employee in good standing, unquote. He also noted that Rivera passed the government's E-Verify employment verification system, despite his status as an undocumented immigrant. The system is intended to maintain a database of I-9 forms and tax records of employees across the country. Quote, this is a profoundly sad day for our community. All of us at Yerba Farms are shocked to hear that one of our employees was involved and is charged in this case, Dane Lang said in a statement. He went on to say, on Monday, the authorities visited our farm and talked to our employees. We have fully cooperated with their investigation, unquote. Tibbetts went missing on July 18th, and in the month since her disappearance, authorities worked to locate the 20-year-old. She was last seen jogging near her boyfriend's home while she was staying at where she was staying while he was out of town. Authorities on Tuesday announced the arrest of Rivera, who led them to the body of Tibbetts. She was found dead in a cornfield near 460th Avenue and Highway 21, a rural part of the county. Rivera has been charged with first-degree murder and is being held on a $1 million cash bond. Rivera told authorities he was following Tibbetts in his car before getting out and running alongside her, according to the affidavit. He said she threatened to call the police, at which point he allegedly panicked and blocked his memory, blocked in quotes. He allegedly said he later pulled into the entrance of a cornfield and found Tibbetts in his trunk with blood on the side of her head. He then pulled Tibbetts from the trunk of his Chevy Malibu, hoisted her over his shoulder, and carried her about 20 meters into the cornfield, the affidavit read. He allegedly left her face up and covered her body with corn husks. It was in this position that the authorities found her on Tuesday. In a press conference on Tuesday, authorities said Rivera had seen Tibbetts before, but couldn't comment on whether or not he was stalking her. They said surveillance footage from locals was instrumental in identifying Rivera and his car. Authorities said they were still investigating the events that led to Tibbetts' death. An autopsy was planned for Wednesday.
And the Washington Times on August 21st added what Governor Kim Reynolds said of Iowa. The search for Molly is over, but the demand for justice has just begun. As Iowans, we are heartbroken, and we are angry. We are angry that a broken immigration system allowed a predator like this to live in our community, and we will do all we can to bring justice to Molly's car. And I believe that Rick Ron, a special agent in the state's Division of Criminal Investigation, said, we have confirmed with Homeland Security investigations that he is an illegal alien. And Mr. Rivera told police he had seen Tibbetts before. It was not clear why they interacted that July day, but police said he seems to have circled around her as she was jogging, then stopped his car and began to run alongside her. He told police that she grabbed her phone and told him she was going to call police. He said he panicked, got mad, and then has no memory of events until he came to an intersection and drove into a cornfield, according to an affidavit filed with the charges. He realized he had her body in his car and dragged it into the field, where he left it face up, covered in corn stalks. After police found him, he was able to guide them to the body. He followed her and seemed to be drawn to her on that particular day, and for whatever reason, he chose to abduct her. Tibbetts' slaying is likely to join that of Kate Steinle, the 32-year-old woman killed while walking the San Francisco waterfront with her father in 2015, as flashpoints in the immigration debate. Steinle was killed by an illegal immigrant who had been deported repeatedly but sneaked back into the U.S. each time. The Department of Homeland Security had him slated for yet another deportation, but he escaped their control after he was released from jail under San Francisco's sanctuary policy protecting illegal immigrants. So a lot of things are coming to a head here. Senators Chuck Grassley and Joni Ernst, Iowa's two Republicans in the Senate, echoed the governor, blaming the immigration system for allowing a predator to roam the community. And they pointed to another case from several years back, which another young Iowa college student, Sarah Root, was killed by an illegal immigrant in a drunken driving collision in Nebraska. He posted bail, and police, unable to hold him, repeatedly tried to get Homeland Security to place a detainer on him to keep him in custody. Obama administration officials at the time said his crime wasn't serious enough to warrant a detainer. The suspect, Eswin Magia, disappeared into the shadows and is believed to have escaped back to Honduras. He is now on U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement's most wanted list. And so I believe that President Trump commented on this. He said at a West Virginia rally Tuesday night, "You saw what happened to that incredible, beautiful young woman. Should have never happened illegally in our country." And that is just so true. But we have the cover-up of the truth, just as in that little cartoon I read to you. And interestingly, we can't get into all the Muslim news probably tonight, but in Time Magazine, August 13th, 2018, there was an interesting article, "The Tourism Trap," in the world news, as vacationers threaten to turn Europe into a theme park. The continent is pushing back. Oh, my goodness, Lou, the main enemy in Europe is tourist vacationers.
It's those vacationists again, those ugly Americans and those ugly, oh, Russians and whoever. They just can't stay away from all these things like the Eiffel Tower. It's the one that doesn't collapse under the weight.
And we told you that we hope there are still some copies of the DVDs left at ChristianBooks.com. You can go there, ChristianBooks.com. There's a two-DVD set called Europe's Last Stand, and it was selling for only $5 for part one and $5 for the other one. The liars who want us not to see the danger. That's why we are trying to be watchmen on this program. And again, if you would like to correspond with us or help us, you can write to Lou, L-O-U, Caverly, C-A-V-E-R-L-Y, at Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. And again, that is Lou Caverly at Post Office Box 28, Bethlehem, Maryland, 21609. And when we mentioned that we have this cover up here, we talked about it the last time, of these jihadi fighters going underground. This article that was in the Washington Times, August 15th, said that some 20,000 to 30,000 fighters loyal to al-Baghdadi's Islamic State movement, also known as ISIS or ISIL, remains active in Syria and Iraq, despite no longer holding significant territory there. According to a UN report that also claims affiliates of bin Laden's original al-Qaeda network are still strong from Africa to Asia. And so here we are. These fighters are going underground. And are they being helped? Or are we really keeping this idea of the poppy fields being cultivated and being guarded by some of our American troops in Afghanistan? As long as we have that, we are not going to be seeing the most significant progress that we can in America. Because even though we have the Trump years now, we need a spiritual repentance in this nation. We need to turn back from the killing of the babies. We didn't get into that very much tonight, but it's still just as important as ever. And, you know, here's a little relief, because there once were immigrants who did want to assimilate. They were different from what we have now. This was from the Baltimore Sun, August 17th, the man who invented Old Bay seasoning, by Christina Tracy. As crab season peaks, it's time to revisit the remarkable life of Gustav Brunn. Born in 1893 in southern Germany, Brunn worked in Europe as a spice merchant, selling seasoning to sausage makers, according to historian Deborah Wiener. She wrote about Brunn in a book she co-authored, On Middle Ground, A History of the Jews in Baltimore. After the rise of the Nazis, Brunn was sent to the Buchenwald concentration camp. Released after 2 weeks, in 1938, he fled to Baltimore with his wife. With the encouragement of his friends in the Jewish community here, Brunn started his own spice company. He used a spice grinding machine brought with him from Europe. Across the street from his downtown spice shop was a wholesale fish market. Seafood purveyors were some of Brune's best customers. The people who sold crabs and shrimp, they made up their own spice blend, said Wiener. Brune, quote, thought he could do a better blend than the seafood purveyors themselves were coming up with, said Wiener. Brune tweaked the basic recipe that many sellers already used. An antique bottle on display at the Baltimore Museum of Industry lists the ingredients: laurel leaves, mustard, salt, pepper, cardamom, cloves, paprika, and ginger. The concoction was called Delicious Bran Shrimp and Crab Seasoning. A friend in advertising suggested something catchier. They used the name of a local steamship line, Old Bay. Lou, you love your crab cakes, don't you?
Oh, yeah. I've been born in Massachusetts like lobster, but now crabs are the thing when you're down here near Chesapeake Bay. Great stuff. And that Old Bay seasoning really makes them good.
And we have to hope that we are going to have this repentance in this country. And we are still wondering about Obama, that rumor that he might become the Secretary General of the UN. August 10th, Byron York, columnist who is syndicated, wondered, where's Obama? And he says that he doesn't seem to be around. The Democrats don't see him anywhere. And he says there is no leader of the Democratic Party. And for Democrats, Obama, who isn't running for anything, could be as close to a leader as an out-of-power party can have until the Democrats' next presidential nominee comes along. But he's just not taking the job. In June, New York Magazine published an article with the almost plaintive headline, "Where is Barack Obama?" Writer Gabriel DeBenedetti portrayed a former president who, for whatever reason, has decided not to stay up on day-to-day politics, focusing instead on the new Obama Foundation and on his memoirs. In private conversations, Obama rarely mentions Trump at all, DeBenedetti reported. Those who visited the office he's leased from the World Wildlife Fund in Washington's West End say he's eager to talk for hours about the world's ills. When informed about the latest presidential tweet storms aimed at him, he chuckles and changes the subject. DeBenedetti talked to Obama friends who marveled at the former president's zen-like calm in the face of the Trump tumult. That, of course, was a phrase often used to describe Obama in the White House, too. Maybe that works for him, but for his admirers and many Democratic voters, Obama's absence borders on the mysterious. How did the most ubiquitous man in America for 8 years virtually disappear? DeBenedetti asked. What explains his near absence from the political stage, where he might argue publicly against the reversals of his policy accomplishments, and also from American life more broadly? What could Obama do for Democrats this November? There are certainly states and districts in which candidates would welcome an appearance, but probably more important, he could travel the country raising millions and millions of dollars for Democratic candidates. For that job, the only thing better than an ex-president is a sitting president, and Democrats don't have one of those now. Actually, one Obama is doing some shoe leather work for the midterms. This week came news that former First Lady Michelle Obama would travel around the country in a week-long voter registration effort in late September. That would certainly be welcome in many Democratic circles, but at the same time, no one should be surprised if party activists ask Mrs. Obama, "Where is your husband?" I wonder whether she's being groomed for something, don't you, Lou?
Well, Hillary almost made it, not quite long after Bill's presidency, so maybe it's time to have husbands and wives.
Then we had those scurrilous rumors from True News, and we could certainly not substantiate this. It just seems so far-fetched that Obama's wife was Michael LaVon Robinson, a football player, and that possibly Joan, what was her name, Rivers? Yes, that she didn't die a natural death because she had joked about it. So we're not going out on any kind of limb. This is probably fake news from the swamp. You see, we're in such a time that we don't even think twice about that Somali gang storming the main park. Let's review what that was, Lou.
Yes, this was, it says, Somali gang storms main park, beats victims. This was from May 30th, 2018. And what is just the latest incident of violence by Somali refugees in the United States, A gang has been caught on video attacking victims in a Lewiston, Maine park. Maine First Media reported witnesses said the attack began when one of the victims asked an attacker for a lighter for a cigarette. One victim was hurt badly enough to be taken to a hospital, even though no charges were filed. Maine First Media said a dozen Somali youth, quote, swarmed and attacked two local residents in Kennedy Park last Thursday evening. Again, this is the date of May 30th. The Somali mob attacked around 7:45 p.m., just as the sun was setting on this historic city park in the heart of Maine's second-largest city, unquote. The report said a local mother recorded the video, quote, as a mob of teens and children, boys and girls as young as 9 years old, brandishing wooden bats and other objects, along with fists, feet, and sheer numbers, to attack the two non-Somali defenders, unquote. At one point, you can even hear one of the hoodlums repeatedly daring the woman to, quote, stop me, and the word begins with B, but I won't say it on air, unquote. Lewiston, Maine, Lewiston Mayor Shane Bouchard says these types of incidents are common at Kennedy Park, but points to Lewiston's low crime rate, the report continued. Bouchard told the agency, quote, Kennedy Park is a large common space in the middle of some of the poorest census tracts in the Northeast. When you have large, diverse groups of people in the same place, you are bound to have incidents. Lewiston is no different in that respect from any other medium to large city, except that Lewiston's violent crime rate is one of the lowest in Maine, unquote. I wouldn't exactly call, having been there myself in my younger years, wouldn't exactly call Lewiston a big city.
And then we have this breaking story, August 21st from WorldNet Daily. Muslims chant Allahu Akbar at Viking Stadium. Current scene. Okay, here we are in Minnesota, where 50,000 Muslims are gathering to celebrate Eid al-Adha at the stadium. People can be seen in this video holding signs that say, love thy neighbor, as Allahu Akbar is broadcasted on the loudspeaker repetitively in the background. This is from Laura Loomer. Amid chants of Allahu Akbar, or Allah is the greatest, broadcast over a loudspeaker, thousands of Muslims gathered Tuesday at U.S. Bank Stadium in Minneapolis for a massive rally in celebration of the Islamic Eid al-Adha holiday. KMSP-TV in the Twin Cities reported, Minnesota's various Islamic centers previously have held their own individual prayers for Eid, but this year, with more than two dozen mosques all coming together at U.S. Bank Stadium, they're calling it Super Eid. U.S. Bank Stadium was the site of the 2018 Super Bowl. The organization Super Eid said it hoped to bring together more than 50,000 Muslims from 6 a.m. to noon at the stadium Tuesday to pray, with a celebration afterwards at a park adjacent to the stadium. Imam Asad Zaman of the Muslim American Society of Minnesota told KMSP that Christians and Jews are welcome to join them. On Monday, the Council on American Islamic Relations, remember, you've heard that before, it's CARE, and it's connected with Hamas. I'm interjecting that, Elizabeth Cuppet Caverly. On Monday, the Council on American Islamic Relations, claiming an increase of hostility toward Muslims, called on law enforcement to step up security for the event. That's pretty ironic, isn't it? They're asking for the security stepped up. And the executive director of CARE's national organization, Nihad Awad, has claimed that religious minorities in America face bigotry that could lead to a Holocaust similar to the one that killed 6 million Jews. He said that last year, his organization counted $205 million in spending from 2008 to 2013 by an inner core of 33 groups that were Islamophobic in this network. But WorldNet Daily tells the truth. CARE is founded by members of Hamas, was named as an unindicted co-conspirator in a plot to fund a terrorist group. And CARE itself was designated a terrorist organization by the Muslim Gulf state United Arab Emirates. You can go to WorldNet Daily. You can support their legal fight to expose the Muslim Brotherhood Hamas front in the U.S., the Council on American Islamic Relations. Thank you for listening. Good night.